next on Unsolved Mysteries. After more than 30 years, a man accused of killing his own son remains a fugitive. Police need your help to find him. A young woman plans to marry the man of her dreams, but 3 weeks before the wedding, she disappears. Two women are found shot to death. A single clue connects the murders. A pair of orange socks. And legend describes a world where women warriors dominate men. Scientists may have found evidence that Amazon women really existed. Some hot cases, some cold cases, and some cases with surprising revelations. I'm Dennis Farina, and this is Unsolved Mysteries. Breckenridge, Colorado. A woman's body is found 5 miles south of town. She had been shot twice. Only two clues surface at the scene, a set of house keys and one orange sock. The keys belong to the dead woman, but the orange sock does not. 6 months later, and 13 miles away, another body is found. Another woman has been shot to death. Police are stunned when they discover that she is wearing the match to the orange sock. The murdered women are both locals, 29-year-old Bobby Oberholzer and 21-year-old Annette K. Schnee. They both disappeared on the same day, and both had been shot with a medium caliber revolver. Two victims, two murders. The crime scenes were miles from one another, and the bodies were found 6 months apart. And yet, the police believe that both women were murdered on the same night and by the same man. Prime suspect, Bobby's husband, Jeff Oberholzer.
I can only say that I didn't do anything. Matter of fact, we had just planned several days before that it was time for us to have children. I miss my wife. I did not kill her.
Bobby and Jeff had been married for 4.5 years. Jeff ran an appliance repair business, and Bobby worked as a receptionist. According to Jeff, the day of Bobby's death began as usual. She left home at 7:15 a.m. and hitchhiked to work.
Everybody hitchhiked. You got to know the people in the town, and they got to know you, and they'd look for you to take you over and back if you needed a ride.
At 6:20 that evening, Bobby called to tell Jeff that she was having drinks with friends after work.
Stop off at the pub for a while. Is that all right?
She said she was at the village pub, and she was with friends, and she'd be home shortly.
No, I'll get a ride home with somebody. Okay.
So I proceeded to put the supper on and waited for her to come. I woke up about midnight, and Bobby wasn't home yet.
Bobby?
And the bars close at 2 o'clock, and it's only half an hour drive home. So I thought, well, I'll give her that long. You know, maybe she's just out having kicking up her heels just a little bit and forgotten about the time. Well, when she didn't come home after the bars closed, then I really, really knew that something was not right at all.
Jeff drove into Breckenridge to look for Bobby. Her friends told him that she had left the bar around 7:30 p.m. When Jeff reported to the police that Bobby was missing, they told him that it was too early to file a report. Finally, he drove back home to wait for Bobby. The next morning, A farmer who lived 30 miles outside Breckenridge found Bobby's driver's license on his property. When Jeff and two friends went to pick it up, they made a disturbing discovery.
Oh, wait. I think I see something over here.
I spotted a blue spot in the snow, and her backpack was blue, and so we stopped.
Yeah, this is Bobby's backpack. She wore this when she left.
With the backpack was one of Bobby's gloves, spattered with blood and several bloody tissues. Jeff's friends helped organize a search. 2 hours later, they found Bobby's lifeless body more than 15 miles from where her backpack was discovered. At the scene, police found three intriguing clues. The only footprints near the body were Bobby's. A plastic cord was tied around one of her wrists, and a single orange sock was found nearby. The same day Bobby's body was found, another woman, Annette K. Schnee, was reported missing. Annette was a cocktail waitress in Frisco, Colorado, and like Bobby, often hitchhiked to work. From the start, police believed that the two cases were connected.
When I first asked Jeff if he knew Annette Schnee, he denied it. It was several days later, after seeing her picture in the newspaper, that he came to me and said that he did know Annette and that he had offered to me that he gave her a business card.
Jeff claimed that he had once picked up Annette when she was hitchhiking.
Hi. Where are you headed?
Breckenridge.
Jeff said he had given Annette his business card, but that he had never seen or heard from her since that day.
Okay, well, I'm not in the market right now. But...
Annette's body was found 6 months after she disappeared. Police were stunned when they discovered she was wearing the other orange sock.
It's a wallet here, Sheriff.
Jeff's business card was inside Annette's wallet.
Jeff Oberholz.
The fact that two victims would both be associated or known by one individual makes the investigation tend to focus on Jeff Oberholzer as a primary suspect.
Authorities pieced together a scenario for the two murders. Annette Schnee was last seen in Breckenridge at 4 p.m. in a serious conversation with a dark-haired woman. Police believe that around 5 p.m., she left to hitchhike home. The killer drove 20 miles south of Breckenridge. He took Annette down a short, dead-end road.
She was then either made to disrobe or the man himself undressed her, sexually assaulted, and then allowed to get dressed. While she was getting dressed, she apparently found one long sock, put it on, and couldn't find the second long sock. She then put a bootie on her other foot and her boots on. She apparently escaped, and while running away, was shot in the back.
Police believe the killer then drove back to Breckenridge and found his second victim, Bobby Oberholzer.
Where are you headed?
Just over the pass to Alma.
Great, I'm going past Alma.
Okay.
The killer drove Bobby 10 miles south of Breckenridge to a scenic overlook where he apparently attempted to rape her.
No! No! We believe that during the fight and the subsequent escape by her from the vehicle that the booty came out with Bobby Joe. She escaped from this guy and ran down the highway toward her home and was apparently again contacted by the guy and confronted with a weapon.
I don't want to talk to you, leave me alone!
Whatever happened at that point, the guy ended up shooting her twice as she turned away from him.
My wife wouldn't have gotten into a vehicle with just a couple strange guys. Plus the fact that we had communicated. She knew that she could call for a ride if she wanted to.
No, I'll get a ride home with somebody. Okay.
I think she knew someone and that they left together with a promise to her of taking her home.
2 months after his wife was murdered, Jeff Oberholzer took a polygraph exam and passed. From day one, Jeff insisted that he had a rock-solid alibi.
Joe, you got two choices prepared. You got.
According to Jeff, at the time the murders were committed, he was at home visiting with a friend. But Jeff was unable to produce the witness for police. Then, finally, Jeff's friend surfaced. 9 years later.
When we interviewed the friend a few months ago, he stated that he had been at Jeff's house that night. However, the times that he gave us did not match up with the times that Jeff had given us.
As far as the finger being pointed at me, I'm still very, very angry about that. If they had, different agencies had pursued different avenues and not concentrated so much on trying to find me guilty, we may have found out who had done this to these girls.
Update. There are new developments in this case, and here's one of our staff with details.
Jeff Oberholzer is no longer a suspect in the murder of his wife, Bobby Joe, or Annette K. Schnee. In 2021, genetic genealogy led to the arrest of a mechanic named Alan Lee Phillips, who was seen in the area at the time of the disappearances. Phillips was arrested and taken to the Park County Jail, where he awaits trial on charges of kidnapping, assault, and murder.
Next, thousands of people in Boston are convinced that he can heal with a wave of his hand. Boston, Massachusetts. This brownstone is filled with patients hoping to change their lives.
I'm here to quit smoking, and I've been smoking over 30 years.
Fear of crowds like this.
I came to stop biting my fingernails.
But this is not a medical clinic. It's the office of Yefim Shebentsov, a Soviet immigrant who many believe has the power to heal.
Relax, make yourself comfortable. My name is Yefim Shebentsov.
Thousands have come from around the world to find out if his healing touch really works.
For me right now, people can make appointments. Smoking, drinking, drugs, all kinds of bad habits, phobias, anorexia, bulimia, weight loss.
Knee pain,
mm-hmm.
Back pain.
Okay.
Does this Russian immigrant really have the power to heal? Or is he simply a con artist playing on people's hopes? Can a simple wave of his hand change a life? Well, you watch and you be the judge. Miranda Beeson was a successful New Yorker with a serious health problem. She could not quit smoking.
I really adored smoking, and I smoked great cigarettes. I won't name the brand. I loved them all. But I had tried numerous other kinds of ways of smoking cessation, and they had not been successful, and I thought, I have nothing to lose.
Miranda went to Boston for a session with Yefim and smoked what she hoped was her last cigarette.
Okay, okay, be brave, be brave, be brave, because what we have to do is we have to...
Miranda joined others looking for a cure to their chronic pain or addiction. Yefim held a group healing followed by individual readings.
And who have pain, phobia, some addiction of some sort? You have, who have everybody, you have, why are you here? Why are you here?
I want to quit smoking.
You want to quit smoking. Good.
He's incredibly dynamic.
You have other pain?
Yes.
Pain. You have pain, where do you have pain?
In my back.
And you have
pain. He has a power of focus so that when he focuses on you, you're engaged.
I give you energy.
He kind of sent this fireball across the room and that pain is gone.
Yefim claims that his hand gestures can change what he calls bioenergy.
It's like somebody throwing a really fast curveball. You're the catcher, he's the pitcher, you're there, you catch it.
What I want you to do is to think in your mind the very first puff of cigarette that you take.
In Miranda's private session, they discussed her 20-year addiction to cigarettes.
Some people say he sort of sneezes on you, which is not what he does at all. But he kind of gives you this parting gift.
After her session, Miranda's desire for cigarettes was gone. She claims the craving stopped.
I was somehow profoundly changed. I just know that I'm greater than this habit at this point. So it cannot move in.
According to Yefim, he has helped thousands like Miranda and thousands more who suffer from another common addiction, overeating.
For weight loss, I helped dramatically. I removed desire to eat whatever you want. I removed desire to eat in between meals. I removed desire to eat big portions, etc., etc. But exercise, I cannot do instead of you.
When family stress and financial pressure got to be too much, Louise Cole began overeating.
I would actually hide food just for emergencies for me, and because I knew that it did comfort me. So after things were quiet and everything was taken care of, instead of falling apart emotionally and exhaustedly crying or, you know, just falling to sleep, I would go to the kitchen and bring out my goodies.
Louise tried to stop binging, but she could not. Louise decided to take a chance with Yefim. After her first session, she felt great and within 3 months saw positive results.
I had lost 17 pounds, and now it's down to 20 pounds.
Yefim caught the attention of two Harvard University doctors who agreed to do a clinical trial. The goal was to examine Yefim's success rate.
Two psychotherapists asked Yefim to come and work with a number of patients of theirs whom they had treated without success. These were people with fear of needles, phobias, smoking, pain.
They first observed the healing sessions.
Are you actually a doctor?
No, I'm not a doctor.
The doctors kept track of the trial group for 4 months.
Anybody have questions for me? Nobody question?
He saw all of these patients and managed to cure 85% of them.
Tell me about the tetanus shot.
Well, when I went into the doctor's office, I wasn't nervous at all. I had no fear of the needle.
When the Harvard doctors studied what he had done, they were able to conclude that he had not hypnotized anyone.
No, it wasn't like hypnosis at all.
In fact, they weren't really sure what he had done. They just knew that whatever he did, it worked.
When the Harvard trial was published, the study concluded that Yefim's powers were genuine.
The Harvard study, at most, shows that there is some real effect here, most probably a placebo effect. And when they state that something real happened, they don't mean real psychic power or anything like that, but that a real mental power in the patients themselves happened. I don't think Yefim has any special power at all other than the power to convince people that they can implement change in their own lives.
I don't think anybody knows how it works. I just know that it does work, and I've been very successful with it.
You may go see him and say, I don't understand a word this man says. I don't know what he's doing. You can be suspect, or you can say, you know what? I go around once. What do I have to lose?
During some 30 years of practice, Yefim has seen more than 135,000 patients. Many swear that they have been healed by him, but skeptics claim that his miracle cures are nothing more than the power of suggestion. The truth? Well, that remains an unsolved mystery. Next, a young woman looking forward to her wedding day vanishes without a trace. Richmond, Indiana. It was a hot and humid day when 28-year-old Marilyn Nikki McCown stormed into her mother's kitchen.
Who's this?
These two guys at the laundromat would not leave me alone.
She just was really upset. And I laughed at first, you know, because she's such a pretty girl. I just thought that some man was making a play, you know.
Here you go, Mom.
I said, Nikki, just calm down, because she really was really upset.
Nikki may have been upset, but police believe she returned to the laundromat anyway. No one knows for sure, because on that muggy summer day, Nikki disappeared, and she hasn't been seen or heard from since.
Police had trouble believing that Nikki would take off just 3 weeks before her wedding. They suspected foul play, but without a body and with no apparent motive, they had nothing to go on. It was a complex puzzle with pieces that simply did not fit.
So you guys are gonna get fitted for your tuxedos today?
Yeah, we're gonna
the day she disappeared, Nikki set off to do the laundry while her fiancé, Bobby Webster, met his best man to be fitted for their tuxedos. The wedding day was just 3 weeks away.
She spent so much money, put so much into this wedding. She wanted it to be the most perfect wedding. She wanted her face to be perfect, her hair to be perfect, her body to be perfect. She wanted everything to be perfect.
But Nikki's wedding was not to be. Ever since she disappeared, her family and police have been trying to figure out what really happened.
I'm just gonna borrow this real quick.
Police believe that if Nikki returned to the laundromat, she may have been confronted again by the two strangers.
Wait, come here. What?
Have you seen Nikki?
The day after Nikki's disappearance, Bobby contacted Richmond police to report that his fiance was missing.
Yeah, I tried them, but nothing.
Filling all that information, that missing persons report, was very difficult. It was because a situation like this, you just see happening on like a TV movie or something. You never really think in your wildest imagination you'd be in that situation until it really happens, and it's really confusing.
Shortly after Nikki disappeared, Bobby began acting very strangely. Instead of postponing the wedding, he canceled it entirely, demanding a full refund from the reception hall. Next, Bobby tried to return his wedding band for cash.
Your policy clearly states that if I bring back the ring and the ring is not damaged, sir.
But the manager refused. Nikki had paid for the ring and her name was on the receipt. Allegedly, the argument nearly turned violent.
I'm gonna have to ask you to leave.
Bobby had to be escorted from the store. Bobby's reason was that he needed the money to help pay for Nikki's search.
I was to the point where it's like, you know, it doesn't matter right now. This wedding doesn't matter. Nikki's well-being is what matters right now.
But detectives weren't convinced. They asked Bobby to take a polygraph. At first, he refused, but later said yes.
One of the questions that was asked to Mr. Webster was, did you have anything to do with the disappearance of Nikki McCowan? And he says no, and according to the operator, the needle about jumps off the chart. So not only did he fail it, I mean, he failed it miserably.
Bobby doesn't believe that he failed the polygraph. Neither he nor his lawyer have ever seen the results.
I just said, look, you ain't got to give it to me. Just send it to my lawyer. But they don't do stuff like that around here. That's what they told me.
Nikki had been gone for 3 months before detectives got their first break in the case. Her SUV was found at a large apartment complex in Dayton, Ohio, 45 minutes east of her home in Indiana. Police believe it had been there for weeks. The door lock was punched out, the ignition had been hotwired, and the stereo was missing.
We kept getting told by the police, you know, we gotta locate this truck. It's the big piece of the puzzle. And when they located it, it was a little relief that now they can find Nikki.
An important clue was left in Nikki's SUV, her neatly folded laundry.
The clothes appeared that they'd come just from the laundromat. They were folded neatly. They did not have the appearance that someone had went through the clothing or taken any of the items.
If Nikki had been abducted from the laundromat, why would her clothes be neatly folded in the backseat of her SUV? And who drove her car from Richmond to Dayton? Police were surprised to discover that Nikki had an ex-boyfriend who lived in the same apartment complex where her SUV was found.
He was very cooperative. We checked his alibi. We found out he was at work at the time that she was reported missing. He agreed to take a lie detector test and come through it fine. So we could eliminate him as a suspect.
I don't know what else to tell you guys.
Another dead end. However, police later discovered that Nikki made a phone call to Dayton the day she disappeared.
It's Nikki.
To a coworker who lived about a mile from where her SUV was found.
Do you know where I can find him?
They talked about beauty products, and her friend told Nikki where she could purchase the items that she was looking for in Dayton.
This leads us to think that we've got two different scenarios. Something happened to her over here in Richmond, Indiana, or she drove over to Ohio and something happened to her over there.
Now, there was another theory. If Nikki drove to Dayton, something may have happened to her on the way. But if so, how did her SUV end up in the parking lot where her ex-boyfriend lived? Was it simply a coincidence?
I find it hard to believe. And then if it's not coincidental, then what better way to throw the suspicion off of somebody over here in Richmond?
That theory leads police right back to Bobby Webster and his strange behavior right after Nikki disappeared.
I love Bobby to death. There's no way he could do this. He'd have to be the devil himself to be able to walk around here, still see us face to face, you know? I mean, everybody has their limits.
Nikki's mother, however, isn't so sure about Bobby.
As a wise old woman once told me, keep your friends close and your enemies even closer. So I stuck with him like glue. Because I figured if Bobby did do this, or if he knew anybody did do it, he would come to me.
Police continue to follow up on other possible leads while also keeping a close eye on Bobby Webster.
I believe that based on all the information we have so far, that if Mr. Webster did not have anything to do with the disappearance of Nikki McCown, he does know quite a bit about what did happen to her.
I don't know anything about Nikki's disappearance or whereabouts. I have nothing to do with it. I mean, I love Nikki more than I love myself. And all I wanted to do was just be the best man I could. And, you know, it feels unfair that I'm in the situation that I'm in now. Just because I love so much, you know? I just don't understand it.
Nikki McCown is 5'2" and weighs 115 pounds. She has brown eyes, brown hair, and a small scar over her left eye. If you have any information about this case, please log on to our website at unsolved.com. Next, a father wanted for the murder of his own son is still a fugitive after more than three decades on the run. Southampton, New York. 21-year-old Nancy Heyer and 19-year-old Billy Fisher met by chance. Their friendship began when Nancy became hopelessly lost on a train and was on the verge of tears. Billy stepped forward and offered to help Nancy escorting her home to Hicksville, Long Island.
Nancy thought Billy was a really nice guy. She did say to me, he's starting to look at me like a girlfriend kind of thing, and I don't like him that way. But she didn't want to hurt his feelings because he was so nice.
On a stormy night 3 weeks after they met, Nancy got a call from Billy.
Come work tomorrow, okay?
Nancy told her sister, Deborah, that Billy needed a ride home from his father's house in Southampton, about 65 miles away.
And I said, I can't believe you're going to drive in this weather. You don't even like to drive at night. And she says, well, he's done so much for me that I'm going to just go.
Nancy's mother, Joan, was also concerned.
As I saw my daughter drive away, I was a little fearful myself. Worry, just mother's worry. That's enough.
When Nancy Hires set off for Southampton, she had absolutely no idea that she was headed straight into a family conflict that would turn violent and deadly. When Nancy met Billy, he was deeply in debt and seriously ill with cystic fibrosis.
Hi, may I speak to William Fisher, please?
Billy hadn't spoken with his father in over a year, but he decided to ask him for help.
Hello.
Hi, Dad.
He was employed by a well-to-do car dealership in Manhattan in the city of New York, was making a very high salary. The investigation determined that he began and had been using cocaine extensively to the point that it affected his performance at his place of employment.
Billy's father invited his son to visit for the weekend to discuss his money problems.
Hey, Billy. How you doing?
Okay.
The day after Billy arrived, He called Nancy and asked for a ride home. That night, Nancy's mother waited anxiously for her return.
The clock was going, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. She might have had to stay over because of the weather or the time of night. But then I still kept hesitant because I said she would never not call me.
Yes, well, I know she's 21, but could you please
The next
call
morning, still no Nancy. Joan and Deborah began to panic. The police couldn't help because technically, Nancy had not been gone long enough to be officially declared missing.
I don't know where she left it.
They searched Nancy's bedroom, trying to find Billy's phone number.
No, wait, here it is. Fisher.
Hello?
Yes, hello. This is Nancy Heyer's mother, Joan.
Oh,
Mr.
Yeah.
Fisher, yes. I'd like to know if my daughter came out there last evening.
Yeah, she was here. Nice to see you, son. Yeah.
William Fisher told Joan that he had dinner with Nancy and Billy, and that afterwards they left in Nancy's car.
He said, oh, they probably just went somewhere, he says, or Billy somewhere and Nancy somewhere else.
If I hear anything, I'll give you a call.
But, he seemed very forthcoming that he was concerned about his own son. We were thinking at that point that young Billy had taken her somewhere and done something.
The next morning, there was still no word from Nancy. Joan filed a missing persons report, but with no proof of foul play, police were unable to help. Joan had nowhere to turn, so she called the last person who saw her daughter alive, William Fisher.
Mr. Fisher, could you go over step by step exactly
However,
what happened then?
During the call, he became confrontational.
They came over.
He would fly off the handle and tell me, let the police handle this. I have no idea where these kids went. And he was getting very, very hostile over the phone.
Goodbye.
So I kept getting more suspicious of Mr. Fisher.
10 days after Nancy disappeared, police responded to a report of an abandoned car in a parking lot less than 2 miles from Fisher's house.
Nancy Heyer? Sergeant, it comes back to that missing girl, Nancy Heyer. See if you can pop the trunk. Oh, my God. Sergeant, get back here.
Located in the trunk of the car was a young Billy Fisher. A second body was located underneath that, and that was young Nancy. The autopsy reported that Billy had been shot 18 times. The vast majority of those rounds were in the head at close range. Nancy's autopsy revealed that she had been stabbed twice with a very long, sharp instrument.
Around that same time, police received reports from neighbors that Fisher had been remodeling his master bedroom in the middle of the night.
Well, you can see it's been freshly painted.
Police secured a search warrant. Slight indentations were observed in a section of wall, and it was removed. Two 22 caliber bullets were recovered. A single strand of hair was fused to one of the bullets. It was identified as Billy Fisher's.
That established that this was the crime scene. Additional testing established that there was a large amount of blood splattered all about the halls of the hallway, consistent with an individual, Nancy, being stabbed in that area immediately outside the master bedroom.
That means
the evidence pointed directly to William Fisher. What could have driven him to shoot his own son 18 times and then murder a complete stranger?
Just the same as always, it's always about money, isn't it? It's you, constantly. All the time.
And I can't imagine a parent killing their own child and then taking someone else's child that they don't even know anything about. I just can't still today believe that anything could happen like this.
Before a murder warrant could be issued, Fisher collected more than $100,000 by mortgaging his house and then disappeared. His car was found at JFK Airport. Fisher has been on New York's most wanted list for more than 30 years and is likely to stay there until he is caught or turns up dead. William Peter Fisher is 5 feet 11 and weighs 185 to 200 pounds. These age-enhanced photos depict what he might look like today. He tends to wear expensive clothing and drinks heavily. If you have any information about the whereabouts of William Peter Fisher, please log on to our website at unsolved.com. Next, a lost orphan is reunited with two brothers after more than 30 years. Memphis, Tennessee. In 1949, the Tennessee Children's Home Society was considered a model orphanage. Director Georgia Tan placed 5,000 orphans with new families and won national praise for her efforts. But Georgia Tan had a very dark side.
When I was growing up, I was told that I was adopted from Memphis, Tennessee. I found correspondence from the Tennessee Children's Home. 2.5 years later, I found my name. 2 hours later, I found my mother.
Cindy Lou Presto also discovered that her mother had never put her up for adoption. The stunning truth, Georgia Tan had simply kidnapped Cindy.
Good morning, children.
When authorities investigated Tan, they discovered that she and a custody judge named Camille Kelly were using the orphanage as a cover for a black market
baby
ring.
Thank you, Judge Kelly.
I'm confident that Camille Kelly was involved with Georgia Tan in this operation. Georgia Tan could not have carried it on without her, and Camille Kelly could not have lived in the style she lived unless she had outside income.
3 days after Robert Taylor presented his report to the governor of Tennessee, Georgia Tan died of cancer. 2 months later, Judge Camille Kelly resigned. The Tennessee Children's Home Society was out of business. But today, hundreds of stolen children are still searching for their natural parents. Update. As the result of our broadcast, another child from the Tennessee Children's Home Society has been reunited with her family. Lynn Heinz was 5 years old when she was adopted.
I was adopted into a very, very fine family, but there wasn't a lot of love in the family. And even though, you know, you try to make the adopted child part of the family, you're always still just a little bit different. And so it meant a great deal to me to find that I really had a true family.
Lynn was born Martha Jean Guggen and placed in Georgia Tan's orphanage in 1949. 3 weeks after our broadcast, Lynn learned that her father and two brothers, Paul and Randall, were still living in Tennessee.
One of the things that I had been fearful of is that the family did not want me to find them. When I did finally get hold of Randall, Randall said, "If you don't come here, we're coming there. Like tomorrow."
Lynn flew to Tennessee the next day. It had been 40 years since she had seen her brothers.
When she walked off the plane, I knew who she was just like that. Well, she's a spitting image of her mother, a very spitting image.
That afternoon, Randall and Paul took Lynn to meet their 86-year-old father, Rufus Guggen.
It's just like yesterday, you know, somebody to love, be loved by, that you never had before.
I would have to say that this is like Christmas, New Year's, everything rolled up into one. When I found the family, I felt like I was queen for a day and all 9 months.
They call them Amazons, fierce female warriors who dominated men. Most believe that Amazons are nothing more than myth. But now scientists working in Russia have found the remains of what could be a tribe of these female warriors. Contrary to popular belief, the legend of the Amazons did not originate in South America, but in ancient Greece. It said that Amazons loved battle and were not allowed to marry until they had first killed an enemy.
The Greeks used the Amazons as the antithesis of what a Greek woman should be. The Greek woman should stay at home, take care of the kids, take care of the house. And the Amazon went out and fought the Greeks, and so therefore she got what was coming to her when she was killed.
Janine Davis Kimball and a team of American and Russian archaeologists have spent 4 years excavating Iron Age burial mounds in southern Russia that date from the 4th century BC. Most scholars believe that early nomads were male-dominated tribes. The men were the leaders, the warriors, and the priests. But these graves tell a different story.
We have women with weapons, women who are actually controlling wealth. We have a different concept entirely of what we think of nomads.
The grave of one young woman contained artifacts that proved she was much more than an ancient housewife.
She had a quiver by her side that had a lot of bronze arrowheads in it. She had a dagger on the other side. And then there was this large boar's tusk that was drilled, and it was probably suspended around her waist from a cord.
Another woman was found with a bronze arrowhead embedded in her body, a sign that she probably died in battle. Who were these women warriors? Are they, in fact, the source material for the legendary Amazons?
We've scientifically proven that there were women warriors, number one. Number two, we also now realize that women have not always been at the bottom of the pit and can control their own lives and be like a woman warrior.
The legend of the Amazons lives on. The Amazon River is named after them. California takes its name from an Amazon queen, Khalifa. And in television reruns, the mythic story of the warrior princess continues to be told.